The Spinoff Podcast Network. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix podcast. Tune in today.
I always approached the dinosaur thing when I was a little kid the same way that, you know, I later would favorite books and music, where you're like, you want something kind of cool and popular, but not too obvious.
For you know, your favorite dinosaur, you mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like in the same way as, like, you know, when you're a white kid growing up in the suburbs, your favorite indie band can't be the best indie band because everyone else likes them. Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? Ankylosaurus.
Nice.
Tēnā koutou katoa. My name is Toby Manhai. This is Gone By Lunchtime. It's just after 9 a.m. on Thursday, October the 12th. 48 hours now, an eerie calm will consume the nation ahead of a tradition, weeks and years in the making, the result of which could define so much in the years to come. As well as the World Cup quarterfinal, there is an election this weekend. Heidi Mai for the last time this side of polling day, Annabelle Lee Mather.
Kia ora.
Kia ora Ben Thomas.
Kia ora.
Over there, Tiahi Butler.
Tēnā koutou.
Our producer and source of great inspiration.
The kind of smooth, unlined face of someone who hasn't been paying that much attention to the election campaign.
That's true.
This is radiating a sort of sense of calm and sort of restfulness.
I've been following closely to everything on the spinoff.co.nz. Having a great time.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thanks.
It's amazing.
Yesterday was a sort of big poll day. Three polls yesterday. There was the Guardian Essential poll in the morning. And the two big TV polls, Reed Research, News Hub, and Verian. I still don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. One News.
I wish everyone said it the way you did.
How do you say it?
Well, don't they say Verian, but the way he says it is Verian, and it just elevates.
It's like the way you
it
say
it. Elevates Mojo. The results. It's how I say Mojo, which I don't mean to do. I think I got it off your Verian.
So there's a lot of Mojo in the Verian and the Reed.
the Mojo levels were dropping, weren't they?
Oh, the Mojo levels.
The Mojo levels were tapering off like a graph of my enthusiasm for the selection campaign, kind of starting to flatline.
It's true. The message of the polls, to be clear, is that Labor falls from an historic majority, single-party majority government to lose. That's the top line. Having said that, it's not quite as big of a loss as it, based on these polls, as it would have been several weeks ago. National wins, but it's not at all the win that has been talked about and imagined for so long. It's a win. It's a three-way government that depends on the support of ACT and depends on the support of New Zealand First. And that has kind of been the overwhelming theme, I would argue, of the last fortnight, is how we got from there to this. Ben Thomas, what happened?
Well, I've been listening to interviews. One interesting feature of this campaign, much more so than I think anyone that we've had in the past, is that the campaign chairs have been enlisted almost as a sort of full-time kind of spin alley to kind of give real-time commentary on their own and other campaigns.
Yeah.
And in these interviews, what I have deduced is that the relative rise in New Zealand First's polling by about, on average in the polling, it's risen by about 1.5% over the last 3 weeks.
Hmm.
National has either stayed static or dropped somewhat. ACT has dropped significantly in the last few weeks from sort of around, you know, that kind of 12, 13 mark to around 8 or 9. Yep. And the only thing we know for certain is that it's not because of the National Party video where Christopher Luxon explicitly ruled in Winston Peters and said that he would pick up the phone if he had to form a government 3 weeks, 1 week before voting started and 3 weeks before polling day. Mm. That has been ruled out by the National Party as a cause. but I mean, look, that's clearly what happened. National New Zealand First had been
well. Just to go back,
I think it would be remiss of us not to give full credit to New Zealand First campaign manager Chris Bishop and the incredible job that he's done for them over the last couple of weeks. It's remarkable.
One thing to add to that is that the reason that video was put out has to be because the polls were telling them that the New Zealand First were there or thereabouts, were between 5 and 6, because the plan had been to ignore them. And that might have worked, you know? I mean, there is, you know, you can argue the counterfactual. It didn't work. It doesn't work. The to pretend Winston Peters doesn't exist, doesn't work. Winston Peters had collected together a bunch of disaffected people to get himself there, and then it was unavoidable. So all I would say is it's not that video that took Winston Peters over the 5%.
The rolling in video or the rolling out video?
The rolling in video.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
No, but I think...
Did I say rolling out?
No, I'm just getting confused because there's been so many, like, National Party Winston videos I can't keep up.
Well, and that's the next thing, right? Yeah, you're right. New Zealand First had been rising and they were borderline. It's probably likely that the internal polling was showing that they were more over 5% than they were under 5%. And there had been pressure on Christopher Luxon to say something about it. He had been talking about it's a hypothetical if New Zealand First are in. They're not in Parliament right now.
Yeah.
I don't have to take a position.
Yeah.
Now, the other counterfactual is you just don't rule it in or out. You say we will try and form a government with whatever the voters give us after October 14. And that really that answers the question. I understand that they were facing a lot of pressure, and they were facing a lot of pressure on a number of fronts. This is when they were also taking a real hammering, in terms of more, people asking for more detail on the tax policy, maybe they thought, look, we're not able to give enough sort of concrete answers. Here's something that we can deliver, or we're not able to give enough concrete answers to the satisfaction of, the press gallery, on the campaign trail. Here's something where we can give a definitive answer. And yeah, unfortunately, it was a two-part answer. The first part was, look, we will cut a deal with New Zealand First if necessary. The second part, which got lost in the noise and sort of was rendered irrelevant, was that's not what we'd like to do. Because at that point, you're putting qualifications on something you've already said you'll do. It's sort of like saying, I after I give you $20, then I start asking you for things in return. It's already done. Then what happened is that in trying to explain that second piece and to try and reel that back, so saying, look, we weren't giving the green light to voters to go to Winston Peters. In fact, we were saying that's the last thing we would really want.
It was amplified and amplified.
Well, yeah, it becomes this kind of a Larry David, curb your enthusiasm thing, where you're sort of like, oh, no, well, what I meant to say is, blah, and then you're explaining the explanation, and then you're trying to perfectly calibrate it. So John Key, they released the John Key video where he's obviously spent the last 7 years out of politics, like, working on his Kiwi accent, because it is a thing of majesty.
I didn't notice that. Was it a particularly... Oh, New Zealand.
He's just in the finest form of his vocal life.
Maybe it was an AI junkie.
And he sort of said, he was very strongly encouraging people, without mentioning New Zealand First, to vote for National. But then, he went on the morning shows and they said, so you're saying National shouldn't work with New Zealand First? And he was like, oh, no, I'm not saying that. And so it becomes this sort of... excruciating millimeter by millimeter sort of attempt to calibrate your position exactly right, which just serves to keep New Zealand first in the centre of the debate with all of the attention on them.
Yes.
Sucks all the oxygen out of the room, particularly for ACT, you know, the preferred coalition partner for National. So, you know, that's contributed to
who've been running a campaign for 3 years.
Been running a campaign for 3 years, who by most agreement has the most disciplined caucus in Parliament, who have been, you know, pumping out sort of, you know, laboriously sort of put together policy, you know, whether you agree with it or not. There's lots of footnotes, there's lots of, you know, explanations, there's lots of like sort of rigorous working, you know, New Zealand First sort of at their leisure just kind of fax out sort of some
chuck a PDF onto the internet and see what happens. Give a few speeches at some halls around
just,
the country.
Just some extraordinary stuff. You and know, then the things you get, like the Dargaville Aerodrome project, just the Dargaville Aerodrome project on which so many of our hopes were pinned, just drops away immediately. It's no longer in the manifesto, but we do have a promise for some Theranos-like sort of immediate diagnosis of all illness.
Hey, has anybody deleted that demand for a free trade agreement with Russia? That's got to go. Annabelle, and then we've got this to the point where I still think this is unlikely, but I was hypothesizing about it last week, and the Guardian Essential poll had this scenario, a nightmare scenario of New Zealand First overtaking ACT. I still don't think that's going to happen, but there it is in a proper poll. I mean, it's just, it must be, I mean, the level of fury within the ACT war room must be something to behold. It's an incredible thing to think, whereas not that long ago there was a conversation about whether or not New Zealand First had even a chance of making it back.
Yeah, I mean, if you'd asked most people 6 months ago if you thought this would likely, that they'd say, I'd never rule out Winston Peters, and everyone else would roll their eyes and think it's cliche. But as it turns out, it's completely correct. And I think, you know, just to go back a bit further into the whakapapa of how this happened, I do think that when Chris Hipkins ruled out working with New Zealand First, that also played.
Hipkins ruled out working with
New Zealand First. That kind of got the ball rolling.
After having been ruled out themselves.
Yeah. So it was sort of unnecessary for Hipkins to do it, given that
it was a
New Zealand First
play.
Except I think that at that point, then the game for the media became putting pressure on Luxon to rule them out or rule them in.
Sure.
Luxon had sort of ankle-tapped himself in that while he kept saying, oh, it's only hypothetical at this point, he'd already hypothetically ruled out Te Pāti Māori, so he kind of was under pressure to come up with a more solid answer and stop dancing around the head of
a pin.
He couldn't
say, I don't do any of that. I don't engage in rulings out, because he'd done it.
Because he had done it already. And I think, you know, history will show that, you know, if you're talking about someone, then they're already winning. And I think Guyon Espiner is right when he talks about the strategic ineptitude of how the New Zealand First situation has been handled.
I was thinking about, you know, the archetypal MMP National Party campaign ad as crafted by Stephen Joyce in whenever it was it 2011 or 2014?
The rowboats,
the Eminem, not actually Eminem, Eminem-esque, pretty legal, dun, 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 and you have this is the opposition offering, with all these motley different colours rowing in different directions versus our sleek boat.
Mm.
And some of that was nodded at in the early part of the national campaign when the coalition of chaos was coined. But the boat now, if you were to imagine the boat, it's like there's this sort of smudge in the depths of the water approaching the yellow and blue boat, and Christopher Luxon says, "Don't worry about that. That's nothing." And then it gets closer, and it's a giant squid, and it's just hanging on the back of the boat. And then Luxon goes, "Oh, yeah, that's fine. That's fine. We can work with that squid if we have to. Also, I don't know what that is. I've never seen it before. I don't know about any squid."
It's an unclassified
species. And then they keep on trying to go. The yellow people get get more frustrated. And then the squid boards the boat. And they start, Skipper Bishop starts harpooning the fucking squid, going cracking, 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 trying to kill the squid. And then he says, we're going to need to get a new boat if we still have the squid. Luxon says, which we can work with if we need to. This is fine. We're going to need to get an entirely new boat. The boat starts sinking. And that's the proposition. That's as laid out. And we've got to this.
That's probably
weird...
a better summary than everything that's just been offered.
We've got this weird situation where everyone was warning about a negative and fear-mongering campaign, and National has turned its guns on itself. It's being negative and fear-mongering about a governing arrangement that it leads. Mm. I mean, what a mess.
Oh, yeah, they fucked up. I mean, the... I mean, look, and there is the. There is no prospect of a second election, right? There's always a
prospect. Bishop is right. There's always a chance, and you know, in any election, in the world, there's a chance of a second election. And in a proportional environment, we see it in Europe, we see it in Israel. People go back to the polls. That's a real possibility.
Tohenare has been saying that for the last 6 months, that he thinks that it's probably going to end up being a hung election. But I think, you know, Chris Bishop's job at this point was to hold his nerve and to just keep running the party line, two ticks
just
National.
Just keep talking about how GST on fruit and vegetables is not going to work and none of the economists like it.
Well, that's right. Liam Dan wrote a good piece in The Herald where he said, you know, there are... few things in New Zealand that the public agrees on more than not voting for Winston Peters. You know, 93.5% of the public currently agrees on not voting for Winston Peters. Why you would put him at the centre of your discussion in the 2 weeks of voting and the week leading up to it, you know, it's crazy.
Also, just quickly on that, in the first part of the resurgence of the Winston Peters surge, he was being... the worst version of himself to my mind, I think I can say to our mind, with that whole I'm going to appoint myself broadcasting minister and sack you, Jack Tame, because you're corrupt, all that sort of nonsense. Now he's going on broadcast media and sounding like the adult in the room and saying, no, the people of New Zealand want stability. Of course I would. Of course we would.
Have to be stability, you know? Right? And this is why there's very unlikely to be a second election, unless you get an absolute hung where there is no... way of getting a majority, is that any party that is seen to have forced the second election will be punished by me, who does not want a second election at the very least.
Especially not this after this one.
Other parts of the electorate as well, I'm sure. And the, you know, and look, it's just maths, right? In all of these polls where National and ACT need New Zealand First for a majority, that shows that Labour, the Greens, Te Pāti Māori could have a majority with New Zealand First. You know, that's the maths of it.
Yeah.
And if Luxon and National can't come to an accommodation with Seymour and New Zealand First, then New Zealand First will go over and they will negotiate with Labour. And we heard Megan Woods was on, in her role as sort of, you know, campaign commentator / chair this morning on RNZ, and she was vociferous. She was emphatic. She said Chris Hipkins has absolutely 100%, no ifs, no buts, ruled out a coalition with Winston Peters.
Mm. And so
now, not a support arrangement like Labour had in 2005,
where Winston Peters was a
minister outside cabinet, right. And they formed the government.
She's adjusting the language.
She has left a lot of wiggle room.
And look, I know you make this point, and you're right that history has lessons here, but I've never seen it so unequivocal from New Zealand First side. This is not the same as it was in the past. They've continued to issue messages to the point where it would be a sort of a betrayal of a promise that I don't think we've seen before.
What
on both sides?
I think that he can perform the mental gymnastics to get around that, though. And I do feel like if National, and in particular Bishop, continues on the current trajectory of threatening another election and all of that, they really risk damaging their relationship with him. And he's the type of person that takes those types of threats and games incredibly personally. So they've all been noted
in his little book.
Yeah, yeah, they've all been noted in his little book. So I think they need to be very careful about how they play this out from here with him, because I wouldn't put it past Labor and Winston of saying, well, you know, because of what's happened, actually we've had to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. The ball's in Nationals' court, right? Just like in 2017 when he didn't want to be propping up a fourth-term national government and his preference was to go with a new and inexperienced leader like Jacinda Ardern, you know, who had sort of real momentum kind of behind her.
Mm.
I think he would prefer to do a deal with National than a sort of third sclerotic term of Labor based on its current polling, you know, coming in at 30% or whatever on election night.
Not to mention in 2017 just going to Annabelle's, you know, grudges recorded. English was there then too.
That's right.
Yeah.
It would help collapse the government way back in the 90s. But if National and ACT can't come to an arrangement, you know, the option won't, you know, the consequence won't be that they go back to the polls. The consequence will be that the great statesman says, the people of New Zealand rendered their verdict on election night. They told us to form a government with this parliament, and I am honouring their wishes.
Maybe. I mean,
if you put aside the obvious personality clashes between Winston and
Seymour,
they actually agree on a lot of stuff. So surely, given how high the stakes are, those two will...
I mean, they agree on a lot, but they're also kind of fundamentally different. Like, if you think of the, you know, places from which they spring, one springs from thinking that the Rogernomics and Ruth and Asia were an absolute betrayal of the core of everything that is New Zealand. The other thinks they didn't go far enough. They're fishing in the same pond as far as a whole lot of stuff is concerned around one law for all, around the rural vote, around crime. But so, yeah, so they could presumably find enough meeting points. Can I just say
one is just an ordinary Māori from St. Mary's Bay, and one is just an ordinary Māori from Epsom.
From Auckland Grammar.
I mean, there's a lot in common there.
That's true. At last, an example of proper tikanga at play in New Zealand politics. Now, just quickly, I want to just mention this on the whole second election thing. Mm. Chris Hipkins has said that he would go to a second election before he would work with Winston Peters. That was asked. Derek Ching wrote a piece about it, you know, because that is the corollary of them ruling out. And it, to be fair, this is what it means when you say we absolutely hope to die, swear on the graves of my grandparents that we will not work with after the election. That's what it means. That they and in a way, isn't there some sense that that's not wholly responsible? I mean,
I feel like you're believing politicians and what they say too much.
I mean, if you look at it, the MMP was designed for us to have a set of different parties with a bunch of values. They come together after the election and then they form an agreement that makes it work. Now, that's sort of worked to one degree or another, but isn't there some sense in which we're stuck in an FPP mindset where the centre party, the New Zealand First, the one that could go either way, is saying, no, we're only going one way. Like, what's the point? Why don't they just form coalitions in advance and we just go in and have an FPP-style election?
Winston is not going to want to go back to the polls. He's been out of Parliament for 3 years. They're just going to be glad to be back in Parliament and in a position of power. They will make a deal work with one of the parties. I don't think we will end up in a second election. I think what could happen is that they do form some sort of coalition or governance arrangement and then the wheels fall off after about 9 months.
Sure,
but I don't think we're going to...
I think you're right. I don't think we're going to go back to the polls, but... have we become a little bit fixated, much too fixated, on the idea that everyone rules in, rules out, and that we know everything in advance? And I know that it's unfashionable to say that top's position is a responsible, you know, to be talk about top, but, you know, whether they can squeeze in or not. The idea of a party saying, leaving to one side what their manifesto is and values is, saying, absolutely, we'll negotiate because these are the things that are our priorities. These are the things that are our priorities, and we will talk to any of the major parties about working with them. Isn't that a mature MMP environment?
Yeah, I think it would be. And you know that certain combinations are not going to fly. You know that despite my friend and colleague, former colleague Matthew Houdin's remonstrations every 3 years, there will not be a Teal deal. There will never be a Greens National coalition. But at the same time, the Greens and National have worked together on memorandums of understanding when the National have been in government. You know, there is no reason...
Could do again. They told me that in an interview, yeah.
There's no reason why parties can't work together across the spectrum. I guess the only caveat is that when people are casting their vote, you know, you cast votes on a number of things. Back when I was a little 20-something nerd, I was like, you should only vote on policy. You should just go through, look at the policy on the page, whatever you agree with. You know, if you agree with them, most of it, you know, you vote for that or whatever. Mm. Now that I'm a 45-year-old nerd, you know, I'm sort of like, no, you've also got to take into account things like, well, how likely are they to be able to do this? You know, I mean, you might want to, help New Zealand overthrow the Ukrainian government and vote for the Māori Party, but how likely are they actually going to be able to do that in part?
Dinosaurs, you vote on dinosaur preferences a lot now.
That's right. We want moas and dinosaurs cloned. We need to get Trevor Mallard back from Ireland, where he's been on an archaeological dig to get DNA. So there is a question of, in terms of how can they get their program implemented, you know, who can they work with, you know, are they able to enter into a government, that kind of thing. But yeah, I think we do over-egg it. I think that the 24/7 news cycle, you know, they want, you know, it is demanded that you have concrete answers to everything immediately. And I think in terms of, you know, speculative scenarios after the election, that's probably not that helpful because it does kind of end up pinning you into a corner. Yeah.
I think voters should have the assurance of knowing what way their vote's going to go, how it's going to be used after the election, if it's going to support a left bloc or a right bloc. You know, I get that some centrist parties like to say we'll see how the cards fall and whichever has the largest majority afterwards is how we'll go. Like, I think that's a reasonable position. I think what's unreasonable and what has happened in the past is when parties adamantly rule out working with a certain side and then go with them anyway. I think that's a betrayal of the spirit of MMP.
Who's done that?
All right.
Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Let's talk about the Labour Party, which we, you know, amazingly, it is kind of, you know, there must be such a relief in the fact that
they're describing it as a surge.
Being able to just,
they're back up to 27.5 in one poll. They're like, the surge is on. Right.
That Essential Guardian poll did put them over 30, which seems to be higher than even their internals are telling them.
That poll seems to be out of step with other polls. Now, it might turn out to be right, but it's three iterations out of step.
It seems like an exaggeration of the trends that we're seeing in other polls.
That's right. It tends to cluster National and Labour sort of together in the low 30s.
But does Labour, yeah, their idea that they're now they've got lots of wind in their own sails and everything is turning around, a million people have voted already. Do they have a path to power, do you guys think? I mean, Audrey Young wrote a piece for The Herald in which she explored what would need to happen, and they had quite a cool Chris Knox did quite a cool little data visual thing where you could toggle to see how things would move.
Just 1% off here and 1% up there.
And it basically needs a whole – you need to basically win Powerball and scratchy ticket. You need to win everything at the state. You know, so that's how it would need to fall. Having said all that, Ben, I mean, if you look at the polls last time, the last two TV polls, have you got that there, Annabelle? The last two TV polls in 2020 gave undercounted Labor and overcounted National versus their result, right? Now, I think that was probably an aberration to do with the very high turnout, and turnout is a big deal. But is there a scenario where we've seen it happen in elections around the world, in Australia and Spain and various places, where the polls are a bit out, there's a bit of a shift in mood, and that on Saturday night we're sitting there going, holy shit.
I mean, look, we can't rule it out. And the major reason for that is that the way the polls have shifted over the last 6 weeks have shown that campaigns do seem to matter day to day. You know, the things that happen in a week do seem to affect the polling.
Because we've had a few campaigns where they've felt like it hasn't,
yeah,
right?
And yeah, and in 2017 it did. In 2020, what really sort of happened was, you know, in 2020, the reason I think there was that that overcount of National was what we've seen is that a lot of the time in MMP elections, if the major party, usually the opposition party, but, you know, in this case it would probably be the government, is really struggling and hits the 20s, their support kind of falls off a cliff in that last week as people either stay home or, you know, look for an alternative in the minor parties. Now, I think what Labor will be really happy about is its quote-unquote surge suggests that that may not happen to them this time. They may not go down from 26 to 24 or 23 or something on election day, and they might be able to stay up there or even improve their
because
vote.
Because that energy translates into turnout? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, turnout is the big question here, right?
It's a truism, but it's critical. I was looking back at the Stephen Levine book about the 2005 election, and you know, that election, which has been used as an analogue for this one in many ways, and in many ways it is, in many ways it isn't. They put it down to there's a lovely bit with who's the Australian polls guru for ABC. He relates walking down Ponsonby Road at 8 p.m. on Friday night, and Helen Clark was still out campaigning, and they went so hard all the way to the end on doing the cliche alert ground game and just bringing people out, bussing people out, knocking on their doors, getting them to the polls. That's what's critical, right?
I remember seeing Helen Clark that night at Galbraith's.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She did a sweep and probably see all the old unionists there, I guess.
Oh, my God.
And that's that
Anthony Green, is that his name? Yeah, sorry, Gary.
That's the election sort of in a simplification, people say South Auckland turned out and saved Labor.
Sure.
Now, everyone's been predicting a low turnout election. What we've seen is much lower advance voting than last election. You know,
much lower than last election, but higher than 2017.
And so, it's unclear is that an indication of lower turnout across the board, or is it an indication that 2020 was just a super aberration because of COVID and people didn't want to wait in lines or whatever? And a lot will depend on that. You know, if there
also there were more polling booths and there were more days in advance.
There were
voting
more days. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, if we have a comparable sort of turnout, I don't think we'll get up to 82%. But if we have a high turnout again, that's going to help Labor. If it's, you know, these are traditional rules of turnout, which is that low turnout helps conservative parties, high turnout helps left-wing progressive parties. So, you know, if you get near 80% again, that would, you know, definitely help Labor. That suggests that they might go up a little. There's been a lot of talk about the undecided vote, which is still reasonably high, about 10% on most of the polls.
Mm-hmm. And some speculation that it may be a lot higher than that because undecided voters aren't picking up the phone and talking to pollsters.
Yeah, I would tend to think that in a lower turnout election, undecided voters simply won't vote.
Just vote me, okay.
You know, what's really going to matter is people who sort of had decided to vote National or, New Zealand First or something, and they're going back to Labour.
Mm.
And, you know, is there much more scope for that with 3 days to go? Well, who knows? There's another leaders debate. You know, these things get watched by a huge amount of people.
Mm.
It's actually pretty crazy when you sort of think 1.1 million supposedly watched that first TV1 leaders debate. It's the closest to sort of monoculture that we kind of have in TV land now. And if you've still got, you know, if you think the turnout will be similar to last election, you know, still 70% of people almost to vote. So, anything's possible, but, you know, everything has to sort of fall into place for them.
I don't think it's impossible. I think that, you know, we can see from the 2020 election that the left bloc's count was quite significantly underestimated in the polls in the lead up. And so I think it is possible. I think that, you know, National may have peaked too early, that the confusion over some of their policies, the criticism of their tax policy, the landlord stuff, the managing of the relationship with New Zealand First seems to be helping to drive Labour's vote back up and theirs down. What I'm really interested to look at this election is the international vote, because we know in the past that the international vote tends to favour the left. But I'm curious to see how COVID and the way the government managed that impacted that vote. And, you know, obviously there was a very noisy lobby group, Grounded Kiwis, that kind of gave the impression that New Zealanders living overseas felt abandoned and hate New Zealand now. So I think
this election
will be a bit of a litmus test about whether that was a widely held view, or if in fact it was just a couple of...
I mean, the international vote tends to really support, I think I'm right in saying, the Green Party.
Yeah.
And I think whether or not people would hold the Green Party responsible for. So it may be that the Green Party hold theirs, but whether or not it affects Labour, you know. Mm. The only other thing worth remembering is that when we talk about the special vote, a minority of the special vote is an overseas vote.
Mm,
most of it is people who are voting in New Zealand but not in their own electorate. When you look at the special vote as a whole, that isn't what Annabelle's talking about. It's the overseas component of that reflects that. What else? I mean, what else about that? Speaking of the Greens, I mean, a lot of what they have managed to achieve is by holding on and accepting the defections of voters on the left, right? But they need to be commended for a pretty remarkably successful campaign, given they've had some hiccups and campaigns on the past. They've held their line. They've stuck really clearly to their answers. It's so easy to get caught up in the who would you support, all the stuff we've been talking about, the bottom lines ruling, and they've stuck incredibly disciplined fashion to their lines on that. They've laid out substantial policy documents. They perhaps haven't faced quite the level of scrutiny you could argue that the right have, because the polls haven't suggested that they like to be part of a government. Mm. But James Shaw, Marama Davidson, just, you know, doing, you know, being visible. And if you look at the Google searches after the debates, performing pretty well. I mean, how would you rate the Greens' performance, Annabelle?
Well, they've achieved an extraordinary feat by being a minor party that went into a coalition and actually managed to grow their support as a result of it. And to be fair, that may not necessarily be because of the way they performed in the coalition. I think that probably quite a significant amount of that vote is how annoyed left-wing voters feel about Labor and their position on a wealth tax. But nonetheless, extraordinary, particularly given what a crappy coalition deal, a deeply ungenerous coalition deal they got from Labor.
Even a coalition, was it? It was just here's a couple of warrants. Yeah.
But I think Marama Davidson has put on a remarkable performance as co-leader over the course of the campaign. The way she's performed in the debates has been, I think, incredibly strong. Same with James Shaw. I feel like we've really come to see who James Shaw is as a person. During the debates, he's come across as just more personable, more likeable. You know, I liked the ways he reminded when there was the discussion about law and order in one of the debates, he talked about, you know, I know what it's like to be a victim. I got beaten up on my way to work one day. Just those really human moments, I think.
Also Greens funny. Have, I think it's easy to think of James so Shore as funny. Quite, you know, he is quite nerdy and he is quite serious. He does talk a lot of, you know, people who talk about the emissions trading scheme a lot aren't necessarily seen to be the life of the party. But I think he's let his funny side come through a bit.
And also a little bit of bite too. Like he, you know, ran some lines against David Seymour that during the debates got some of the biggest laugh and the biggest response. And I think people have sort of seen him as a little bit of a wet blanket. So to see him kind of having a little bit of a bite has appealed as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, James Shaw has eaten a lot of shit over the last two parliamentary terms. Most of it from his own party, you know, sort of getting rolled in favour of no one as leader, you know, having the plum seat of Wellington Central sort of presented on a platter by Grant Robertson, and then the sort of youth, the young
get
people
some text messages,
and you know, to his credit, you know, never seems to create a fuss. Just comes out and says, you know, when he's asked about it, just says, "Oh no, look, you know, old white guys like me, it's time that we got out of the way for young leaders like Tamitha Paul." You know, he's eaten a lot of shit, and he's finally, you know, and he's you know, it's paying dividends for him. And for the party, you know, he even looked happy yesterday when he was talking about the poll results on TV3, I think, to maybe
TV1.
Well,
I think the likelihood is, if
and
I
it's just going to be
guess...
even more of a surprise when, you know, the 18 new Green MPs all, like, jump him and shove him into
well,
a gravel pit
except,
after
except
the
you,
election.
I think it's, assuming it's a national government, I think the likelihood is that he will say, well, I'm not going to stick around for another 6 years. And so unless National, we try something new and they appoint him climate change minister, which, you know, then I think he'll probably stand down. And being a List MP, you know, makes that more straightforward. But then to leave sort of 16 or 17 Green MPs would be quite something. What about Te Pāti Māori? I mean, Annabelle, I kind of, it seems to me they were running a brilliant campaign from Parliament, in Parliament, being visible, being on the news, being funny, doing some stunts, appearing radical. In the campaign, they slightly disappeared for me. Maybe it's because I am looking at more mainstream media.
Yeah, well, I just think that the Māori seats never get covered the same way other seats do. So, I mean, that's half the battle, is that you're just not getting the same level of exposure as what other parties and other seats are. I think, you know, obviously they've had a tough one because Rawiri's mother was sick during the campaign and then passed away a couple of weeks ago. So that's obviously, you know, been a challenge for them in terms of what they've been able to do. And I think Deb did quite a lot of the heavy lifting at the start, and Rawiri's started to pick it up again over the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. For me, I think, you know, the Hana Rāwhiti obviously has helped to draw attention to their campaign, but I think the most extraordinary performer in the Māori Party and Te Pāti Māori has been Takuta Ferris. Takuta Ferris has been absolutely phenomenal. His performance in the Stuff debate, his performance in the Hui debate. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the any of those, but the video of Takuta talking about climate change and relating it back, like really speaking to Ahika, talking about, you know, for all the divers out there whose job it is to go and fill up a sack of, you know, kinners and keep kaimoana on the table for our tangies in 21st. You guys can see it yourselves. Yeah. You know, like really speaking to the people and running, I thought, you know, extraordinary, and, you know, his holding his own against Winston Peters and David Seymour. And I think it's such a shame that he's not higher up on the list, because that's
fifth, standing in Te Taitonga, which is
and he's put up a good campaign against Reno too. Reno is, like, you know, is so incredibly well loved down south, but I think
the Tidakatni name guarantees
absolutely,
at least
but
in that seat.
I think you know, Takuta and Hana Rāwhiti, those types of candidates, they are the future of the Māori Party, mm. and much respect to Mecca,
mm.
but Mecca isn't, you mm. know, and I think that they should be trying to get people like Takuta much higher up the list and much more exposure for him because, man, he can really perform.
And that shows, I think, a weakness in their campaign. I think if there have been two losers out of the campaign of the established parties, well, I suppose you'd have to say Labour because their numbers started to really go down when the campaign started. But, you know, ACT and the Māori Party were two parties that I think had a lot of momentum going into the campaign.
Mm.
And I think they've both stalled and, in fact, gone backwards. The Māori Party, I think it's a strategic error because they have, you know, I think like Annabelle said, they've really focused on the electorates. Electorate campaigns don't get a lot of coverage mm. outside, you know, the centres themselves, and even then, not a lot because, you know, there's been a real downgrade in terms of community news, that sort of thing. So much of that is done centrally now. You know, that's why, you know, it's ridiculous, but that's why Auckland Central gets covered so much because it's closer to all the media. And if you want to get in, good candidates who have no chance of winning the South Island
mm.
and, you know, little bits of Wellington, you know, you need those party votes, but also, so you need to be getting votes from everywhere you can, but also the electorates, your electorate bids are helped by the national campaign.
Mm.
And the Māori Party have made a mistake that I see a lot of PR people do, which is, and it's quite a rookie one, where you say, we're targeting Māori voters, so we're going to go on iwi radio, we're going to go on Te Karere, we're going to go on Tau. But, you know, most Māori voters are watching, you know, to the extent they're watching media at all, they're watching the same thing everyone else is watching, which is One News and Three News and TVNZ Breakfast. And that's actually how you get that coverage. And so by trying to be sort of flex roots, I think the Māori Party have really kind of kneecapped themselves, I think, in this campaign.
And to be fair too, that's a challenge for them because if they don't make time for Māori media, we get upset about it because we're like, hey, we're Māori media. You should be prioritising us. We should be getting, you know, first dibs over any of the other networks. So,
oh, for sure,
so that's the balancing act that they face too, is the kind of cultural obligations they feel to prioritise Māori media and real Māori media while still getting exposure. You're 100% right, Ben.
We've got to get out of here. Has anybody got any last thoughts before we go to the polls?
No, I tried to make a joke before, but it didn't work.
Do you want to have another go?
No.
Was that Te Tata? Was it the one about the dinosaurs and the Te Tata? Yeah.
That was good.
It was good. Yeah, it was good.
Stomping on the indigenous mana of Te Tata, but I'm not going to go there again. Let's not talk about it.
Ben?
Oh, look, let's just end on a downbeat note. in keeping with this stupid fucking campaign. Because, you know, look, it's been a sort of cost of living campaign. We've been beaten over the head with that for the last year and a half. And as such, I actually don't think the public has been particularly well served on it by either politicians or media. I think it's incredible that after the flooding and the events in Te Tai Rāwhiti at the beginning of the year that just didn't figure.
Yep.
You know, I think there was one question about it at the TV3 debate, and it was a sort of what'll you do kind of thing. You know, but no, we didn't really get into issues of climate change adaptation, which I think is one of the crucial things that came out of that and will affect the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Forestry was very cursorily examined. You know, so much of the stuff, you know, focuses on the minutiae of the $20 bid here and the $40 working for families bid here. And, you know, we all know that can be very powerfully part of what people vote on. But look, there is a wider world out there. And I think it's a shame that, you know, both the parties in particular, you know, just zero in on where their focus groups go. You know, it's understandable, but it's a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. Likewise for domestic violence, you know, there's a story in the paper the other day about a guy who killed the mother of his three children and drove her around in the boot. And we've had no meaningful discussions about domestic violence. It's all focused on ran raids and youth crime and not the actual epidemic that's plaguing this country.
Well, on that note, we might be a bit downbeat and a bit dispirited and a bit disgruntled.
Adding the two towers to look
after this. Disappointed.
But, you know, look, it's been fun to be with Ben and Annabelle and Tiahi and Sam and everyone else, and especially you listeners. We might be a little bit dejected, but our love for you is unwavering. And
indeed.
We'll be back on Sunday, won't we?
Yeah.
To preview the second election.
Comb through the ashes. That's right. The first preview podcast for the second general election of 2023. Kia ora.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spin-Off. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spin-Off member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spin-Off Podcast Network.